And I'm Jimmy.
So, how have you been lately?
Doing well, you know, just same old, I guess.
Anything interesting over the past week?
Man, gotta think of... I guess nothing. Unfortunately, nothing interesting happened to me last week.
Oh, okay. Well, I had moderately interesting last week, or last weekend anyway. My weeks tend to be pretty mundane. You know, it's more of the same, going to work, working on stuff, then relaxing, playing video games in the evening. So that tends to be my weekdays. Sometimes there's variation, but usually not. My weekends are what really change. And this weekend I did a meetup, which was pretty fun. And then I went and saw Distant Worlds, which is the Final Fantasy Orchestra. So I guess it's this guy who put together the orchestral pieces of all the Final Fantasy music, or at least like the really good Final Fantasy music, or the really well-known Final Fantasy music. And he got the actual permission from Nobuo and Square Enix to do it. So it was pretty cool.
So it's like all the Final Fantasies or just like certain games?
Well, so it's only a 2-hour concert, so it's not like they can cover all of them, but they covered, if I recall correctly, they played at least one song from each game. Like they even had one from 15 in there, and then they had one from 13, so. And they even had 14 and 11, the JRPGs. They had some of the songs from that.
I feel like after not... Well, I played 10 and then 10-2. But I don't know. I feel like 8 was my favorite. I really liked the summons. In 8, they called them the Guardian Forces. Those are my favorite things about Final Fantasy.
8 was my first one that I ever played. So there is a nostalgia factor to it for me. But it's definitely... I wouldn't say it's my favorite, but it's definitely a good one.
I do remember, I mean, this might be an off-tangent story, but back in the day, when you played Final Fantasy, it was multiple discs in your PlayStation. So I believe Final Fantasy VIII was like 3 or 4 discs long.
It was 4, yep.
So I got it as a gift. Like, my parents were like, here's Final Fantasy VIII. And I was so excited. And I was moving from disc 2 to 3. But I don't know if I saved or something happened. But when I was pulling out disc 2, I cracked it, pulling it out. And then when I put disc 3 in, I died. And my save file was on disc 2. For disc 2.
That sucks.
So there was no way for me to continue for the longest time. Because, like, you know, renting a game was a treat, so it didn't happen often. Plus, they just bought me a video game. So I had to wait a little bit for the time to come when I could rent a game that I already owned so I could play disc 2 to move on to disc 3. But that's a little side story about Final Fantasy on a King of the Hill podcast.
Hey, we all talk about all things nerddom here, if you will. So no, nothing wrong with that. I never had a CD break or anything. I did have a similar situation happen to me once, though. I don't know if anybody remembers the game, the Dot Hack series, which came out like mid-2000s. But essentially, it was like a series of games, and it wasn't like Final Fantasy or a lot of the other games that you see these days, where like the, you know, it's a sequel. It was like the entire story was, it was one story split across 4 games. And so you had to did like the first game to play the second game and the third game. So I beat the first game. I beat the second game. I went to Best Buy to buy the third game, bought the third game, super excited, ready to play it at home and, you know, whatnot. And when I got home, so my memory card was wiped. Like, all of my games were gone, and I was like, oh, did somebody, like, delete it or something? Did, like, I don't know, my sister get mad at me and delete it or whatever, but no, it was just, it broke. So I couldn't play the game. And like, not only that, I lost all my games that were on that memory card. So I just, that was a really bad
Sunday. I do miss memory cards. I miss having to, I don't know if you ever brought your memory card to a friend's house and like you had characters on your memory card for certain games and you were able to play, you could stick your card in there and you could play them. Like, those are the days.
Yeah, I remember doing that, because if your friend had the same game you did, then instead of having to bring the game over, you would just bring over the memory card. But there's also something about the old cartridge days. So, like, you know, Sega, Genesis, and Super Nintendo, and Nintendo 64, because those games actually saved the game data on the actual cartridge. So it was fun when you'd rent a game and you would just hope that whoever played it before you, like, got past the part you were stuck at. So, like, there'd be times where I was stuck on a boss or whatnot and I had to return the game. And then a week or two later, I'd rent it out again and I'd be like, oh, I hope somebody else rented it. And sure enough, the save file had progressed. So I was like, yes, somebody beat it for me.
I mean, I'm a avid Pokemon player. And I buy a lot of used copies of Pokemon games from, you know, pawn shops or GameStops. And I always find the joy of, like, if someone hasn't erased their game before they sold it, to, like, to see their save files and, like, what Pokemon they've caught and what they have named characters. So it's always fun seeing that kind of stuff.
I agree. That's one thing I miss about the old days of going to Blockbuster or Hollywood Video or wherever and renting video games. You could just play other people's save files and see what they did. You know, there's, you know, I think there's definitely something nice about the fact that I don't, like, nowadays, I don't even have to actually get up and buy a game. Like, I can buy it and download it and never have to leave my house. Heck, I can go ahead and order some food off of Uber Eats or whatever and just never even have to see another human being if I don't want to. But anyway, yeah, there's definitely something nice about that. But there's also just something nostalgic about actually going to a video store and renting a game. And then you were like, you would run in and you would hope, like, just, you would hope against hope that the game was there. And then you'd walk up to, like, the little box or whatnot. And then, of course, you'd look behind to see. So that's how they used to do it for all the young people who are listening. That's how they used to do it. They'd have, like, the actual box in front. Then they'd have, like, the store box in the back. And the store, the actual box that the merchandise came from was there to, like, kind of advertise or let you know that that was the game. But when you rented, you took it home in the store box. And so if you walked up to the game, if you walked up to the game or the movie or whatever, you would look in behind the actual game box and see how many store boxes were there that said Blockbuster or Hollywood Video. And if there were none, you were like, oh man, I can't rent it because they're all rented out. So then you, like, go up to the front and you're like, hey, did anybody return so-and-so yet? And then they're like, nah. And then sometimes they'll be like, oh, it's out until, like, tomorrow at noon and stuff. So then you're like, okay, cool. I'm going to come back tomorrow at noon.
Oh, yeah. I mean, those are the days going to the Blockbuster, you know. We didn't go to Blockbuster that much. There was another store in town that we went to a lot. But that was, like, the trip, though.
At one point, we lived walking distance from a Blockbuster, and that was just amazing. Like, you know, before, well, also that was around the time that I started to drive, so it really didn't matter. But, like, when I was a kid and Blockbuster was, like, a trek to get there, like, you had to drive to it. You know, it was all based on whether my mom was able to take me or not. And then as I got older, like, right as I turned 15, 16, we moved to a place where there was a Blockbuster, like, I could walk to in 10 minutes. But then I also got, like, a car soon after. So it was like, well, now I don't need to walk, but I guess I'm glad that I have it.
Oh,
but yeah, those were the days. I wish I could still rent. I guess there's some rental game services out there. I guess there must be. I never really looked into it because there are games that I want to play, but I don't want to buy. Like, I want to play it, beat it, and then I probably will never play it again, but I guess we'll see.
I mean, I used to do, what was it called? Gamefly. So I had Gamefly, and that was like the Netflix of video games. Well, I guess back when Netflix mailed you DVDs, I would get mailed a video game for however long I wanted to keep it. But I feel like they went out of business, or maybe they're totally different now.
I have no idea. I remember seeing the commercials all the time, but granted, I don't watch much TV anymore, so who knows? Maybe they still do that. Looks like it still exists, so that's something. But yeah, I do remember seeing it and thinking, oh, that's a sweet idea. Never signed up for it, though. But maybe if it's still around, which it looks like it is, I should. That way I can rent all the games I want to. Hey, check out this segue. Now that we're talking about games, which a lot of them originate from Japan, we might as well talk about returning Japanese for King of the Hill.
Yeah, sounds good. You know, we were talking about Pokemon and Final Fantasy, both big Japanese games.
Yes, they're like one of the hugest, I guess, exports of Japanese, or at least pop culture from Japan. All right, so this one's actually a two-parter, so just like it's two-parter in the show, we'll do two parts for the podcast, one today, and then, of course, you can listen to the follow-up next week. Or if you're just downloading them all at once, then you can probably listen to them all at once. But anyway, so we're going to talk a little bit about Returning Japanese, a two-parter. I know I always say this about all the episodes, but this is one of my favorites of all time. A lot of quotable moments, and a lot of interesting characters as you meet in it. So the episode starts with Peggy at the Arlen Bystander, which is their local newspaper. Peggy is talking to what appears to be the editor-in-chief. They're never really clear, but obviously this is somebody who has some kind of power to approve things that get printed and approve budgets and stuff. And Peggy's trying to, like, you could tell Peggy's like got the scheme going on where she's trying to find a way to get a free vacation. So she's pitching to this woman the idea of, you know, oh, most travel guides or travel articles, travel columns, whatever you want to call it, are written by professional travel writers. What if you sent an average family to a 5-star hotel in Hawaii, and they can just write about all the scenes and everything like that? And, you know, obviously the woman's like, surely you can't think you were the first person to try this. And Peggy leaves rejected. So then we go back over to the Hill House, and it's Memorial Day, and Cotton's there, and pretty much everybody is there. And it is, they're doing like the Memorial Day barbecue, but they're also watching TV, and on TV there's a bunch of stuff going on about, Memorial Day, and talking about the past, talking about World War II, and how 50 years prior we fought the Japanese, and now we're trying to make peace, and there was going to be this peace thing over in Japan. Cotton's getting noticeably uncomfortable by all this conversation, and yeah, they ask, like, hey, what's wrong? Or, well, hey, why don't you just tell us some of your war stories? And then Cotton's just not interested in doing that, which is shocking to Hank because, you know, as the last episode, Shins of the Father, that we reviewed, Cotton loves talking about the war stories and how he killed 50 men in Japan and lost his shins for his country and stuff. But for whatever reason, now he's like, oh, no, I don't want to talk about it. And he's just really secretive. So then Dee Dee, Cotton's wife, his younger wife that we introduced in the previous episode, asks Hank to figure out what's wrong with Cotton. Like, Cotton's just been acting weird lately. He hasn't been talking about it. And at first, Hank is reluctant because he's just like, well, what can I do about it? But then Dee Dee pleads with him, like, oh, please, you know, he needs his son. And so this really kind of perks Hank up a little bit. The Dale and Bill and Hank are like trying to think of things that they can do for fun. nothing really sticks with Hank. You know, they were like, oh, let's go to Six Flags. And of course, Cotton is too small to ride any of the roller coasters, so that's like a terrible idea. And then they said, well, you know, John Redcorn has this this New Age healing center. He has like this sweat lodge, if you will. So they're like, yeah, let's do that. That sounds fun. So they go over and they see John Redcorn and they try to go to the sweat lodge. And, you know, it's $20 a person. So what, four people, $80. And they're sitting there and he's John Redcorn's pointing out that this is like a very kind of sacred ritual for his people where you go and, you know, you sweat out all of the toxins and then you kind of go on a trip, if you will. And, you know, at first Hank is kind of making a joke about it. He's like, you know, for $20, I could have just locked myself in the truck with the windows up. But, you know, they go through the process. All of a sudden, like, they start hallucinating things. So we see Bill. Bill hallucinates himself driving on a fork, like on a motorcycle. And he's naked and he drives straight into a pie. And then we see Dale, who dreams that he's like just finished making love to a woman, but then it pans out and it's like a giant praying mantis and it cuts off his head. And then he's like, oh, I wonder what that, he comes to and he's like, oh, I wonder what that means. Then Hank dreams of Cotton being proud of him. Cotton saying, hey, this was a great idea. And, you know, I'm proud that you're my son and I'm switching the propane and stuff. So I guess that's what Hank's desire is, and then Cotton starts to see all the men he killed and it starts to make him go crazy and he runs out. So we did cover a lot up to this point. What were some of your immediate takeaways on that? I did like Peggy's scheming. That was one of my favorite things in the show. Just, I don't know, like I can't fault her for trying, but she went too hard. Like, if she just said going to Hawaii or something, she might have succeeded. But, you know, hey, send us to a 5-star luxury hotel, man. You don't go that hard on a pitch like that.
Yeah, I really I laughed a lot when she's pitching the idea about Hawaii, but before then, I guess the editor, I guess it's the editor. Because we see later, or earlier, when she first gets a job, it's an older guy. But I guess this is the current editor, or whoever's writing the paper, and she's like, I love your musing articles, but people just love ad space more. And I thought that was hilarious. Kind of a little jab at Peggy. But it is, I don't know. I guess seeing Peggy try to come up with the scheme is fun, and just to see how bad she is at it is hilarious. And I love when Dee Dee asks Hank to take Cotton out, and Hank's like, oh, he just wants to go to a strip club, and he always tips the strippers to put their things on my head. I kind of want to see that. I think that's like Hank being very serious, just like having a stripper put her boobs on his head. I don't know. That sounds like a hilarious moment.
It seems weird that Hank would even agree to go to a strip club with Cotton, because he knows that nothing good's going to come out of it.
The way he said it, though, makes me feel like he's done it more than once. Like, he's like, this happens all the time. So it's like, I think he's done it at least 3 or 4 times, is what I'm going to guess.
I agree. It does sound like this has happened more than once, him going to a strip club with his dad and it getting really awkward. But hey, I guess at least now he knows. But hey, they went to the sweat lodge, which honestly, I don't know. That kind of shocked me, because that didn't seem like something Hank would do. Like, I would peg him as being like, let's go to a football game or something like that. Him saying, let's go to a sweat lodge, a new age healing sweat lodge kind of thing, it's not necessarily something I would have seen coming.
I think he's just out of ideas. Like, all the suggestions were not good. So he's like, I guess this is it.
I guess so. And they didn't have to travel far for it, so I guess that's also a positive. Like it was in the same city. I mean, had they gone to Six Flags, I guess they would have gone to Six Flags over Texas, which is in Dallas, which I guess wouldn't have been a terrible trek, but wouldn't be super close either. So, but yeah, I also liked the hallucinations or the visions or whatever you want to call it they had. Bill crashing into it, like I guess what looked like a giant blueberry pie. I don't know what that dream was supposed to mean, but it was interesting either way. And then, of course, the whole Dale sleeping with a giant praying mantis. And as you know, praying mantis, or at least the female praying mantis, after they mate, they take off the man's head. So did that to Dale. It's like, well, what does that mean? And I'm like, I don't know, Dale, you're the one who's supposed to tell me.
I like the Hank one because I also, for a second I was like, oh, is this real? Because Hank's hallucination is them in the sweat lodge and Cotton praising him. But as soon as he said he's switching over to propane, I was like, oh, this is a hallucination.
Mm-hmm. It is kind of funny that his hallucination, like the other people's hallucinations, were super like out there and weird. But then Hank's was like super mundane. Like he didn't even leave the sweat lodge in his vision. He was still in the same sweat lodge. Now, you can argue Cotton's was kind of boring too because he was still in the sweat lodge. But at least he had, like, dead people coming back to life to haunt him or whatever. So that made it a little more interesting. Yeah, so we go back home. Bobby walks up to Cotton, who's looking at a picture of a woman in a wallet. He tries to... It's obviously, like, a really old photo because it's sepia-toned. And as we know, like, in media, sepia-toned means that it is essentially ancient. But we also, so we see that, and, you know, Bobby's like, hey, who's this? And then Cotton's like, oh, you know, this is spoils of war. I killed a man in Japan, and I took away his wife, and this is the woman that was married to him. So, you know, this is a widow and stuff. And then he's talking about how he wishes he could go back to Japan and make peace and everything. But, you know, he has no shins. All of his money goes to paying for his new baby, as well as his wife's booby payments. And so, yeah. So then, you know, Bobby goes downstairs and tells Hank and Peggy about everything. And he actually kind of pitches the idea to Peggy on making this the trip about, you know, a soldier going back to Japan after having fought in the war to make peace with the widow and the wallet. And that's what they want to call the story. And Peggy's like, wow, that is a terrible idea, which is, Peggy, that is, like, I don't know, I guess that's just her narcissism, like, that, at least, you know, even if you don't like the idea, at least it was well thought out, or better thought out than, hey, let's all go to Hawaii, come on, Peggy. But, yeah, and then Hank's a little upset, because he's like, I went to a sweat lodge with him with nothing more than a towel, some boxers, and a bathing suit. And you get nothing. Bobby talks to him, and he just blabs everything. And so, yeah, that's essentially what's bothering Cotton, is the fact that he wants to, I guess, reconcile with this woman of this man whose wallet he stole after the war, during the war. Peggy goes back to the newspaper and pitches a few more ideas, like, you know, Canada, not just America's hat. And of course, editor's not a fan of that. Then she's like, well, how about this one? I see London, I see France. And of course, editor's like, nice try, Peggy. And then Peggy's like, well, I got one more idea. It's called The Widow and the Wallet. And, you know, though you see the editor, she perks up a little bit, like, hey, this sounds interesting. And then it cuts to the scene showing Peggy running out of the, and she's yelling, the hills are going to Japan. So, hey, Bobby's quote unquote dumb idea is the one that actually won versus Peggy's, I guess, brilliant ideas.
Yeah, and I really do believe that, like, Peggy didn't think there was an idea in there, because usually Peggy pitches that, if someone gives her a good idea, she pitches it to someone else, but, you know, throws her Peggy flair on it. But we see her pitch, like, a couple ideas that don't pan out for her, and she's like, well, last resort, you know, this story.
Yeah, that's true. That was just like her last idea because she nothing else worked. But I don't know, like, granted, you know, we're watching a TV show, so it's a little different. But as I'm sitting there watching it, I'm like, how in the world could she have possibly thought any of those ideas would work? They're clearly like a hustle, if you will.
Well, I mean, that's her. Isn't that the goal? Like, I feel like both parties know, like, this is a hustle. Like, she's trying to get a free trip. Because Peggy's still pitching travel ideas, but one actually lands. So, like, one is actually interesting.
Yeah, I mean, she's trying to pitch travel ideas to get a free vacation, but she needs to, I mean, come on. She must know that if there has to be a better hook to it than, hey, we want to send a random person to Canada to write about it. Like, she needs to know that there needed to be a better hook, but I don't know. Maybe that's just Peggy.
I don't think so. I mean, like, I don't think Peggy thinks... Peggy thinks, like, I am the hook. People want to know what I'm doing in Canada or France. She's like, I'm the hook, that's clearly. True.
But hey, the one that that Bobby came up with worked. And this is also one of the few times, I wouldn't say the only time, but one of the few times we ever see, like, the softer side of Cotton, which is kind of nice to see, too.
I mean... I don't know. It's interesting because he kind of wants something, I guess. And we see this side of him because, you know, he wants something from them.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he, like, I think Cotton is feeling guilty and stuff. And I don't think he ever thought that he would actually get to go to Japan. Like, I think he was just feeling guilty and he opened up to Bobby, probably because he's just fine with Bobby because he wouldn't open up to anybody else about it. I think if Cotton really just wanted a free trip to Japan or something, he would have just said it. I don't know. But, you know, it is nice to see him, like, just being uncomfortable hearing about the war and stuff, because normally he just seems super proud, which I guess, like, I've never fought in a war, so I can't say psychologically how it would affect me. But I'd imagine that I don't know that I'd be super happy or thrilled about unless I was a sociopath or something, that about all the people that I killed or whatever. Like, I would think that, you know, if you're a normal person, which granted, I guess Cotton might be slightly, if not totally sociopathic, but if you're a normal person, you're like, oh, you would have regrets and feel really bad.
Oh, I said Cotton's not a normal person.
But yeah, so now they're going to Japan. You know, at first, Hank is not happy about the idea. Hank doesn't really cross me as a person who does a lot of international travel. In fact, he even made the comment about in the earlier episode about how they were going to do their vacation in Denton, Denton is a smallish town in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So it's like his idea of an exotic family vacation is just going, you know, 2 hours outside of his hometown. But so Hank's like, he's not really a fan of it. Peggy mentions that, okay, well, I was able to trade in the two first class tickets that they bought us for 4 coach tickets. And so that means it'll be Cotton, Peggy, Hank, and Bobby. So they go ahead and they get ready to go and pack. And Hank kind of relents and he has he comes out with some forks as they're all packing, and Bobby brings out his pork pockets and he's trying to put them in the suitcase because he's like, oh, I want to make sure I have these around so that I can, have a taste of home while he's gone. But he's packing quite a few pork pockets. Like, he has to sit on his bag to close it. Like, that's how much he's bringing, which I get it. I've been to Asia before. I've been to Asia for an extended period of time. There's some foods that you just miss having when you're over there, but I've never felt the need to pack them with me. And then he's even like, will my pork pockets work in their microwave? And Peggy's like, no, it's a different frequency, which I don't think is true. I mean, I've microwaved plenty of stuff in Japan. Granted, maybe the frequency is different, but I'm sure it's still cooked. And then Hank is actually packing forks. He's like, he's packing 4 forks, 1 for everybody. Don't lose it because don't know if you're going to replace it, which, you know, I'm going to let you in on a secret that you can find forks in Japan. So before they leave, Hank asks the guys to take in the newspaper. His logic was, you know, if his newspaper starts piling up, it's a signal to robbers that, hey, here's a guy who can afford to have a subscription to a newspaper, which, you know, wouldn't be the first thing I would think. I'd be like, hey, if newspapers are piling up, here is somebody who's not home, so go ahead and rob them. But I guess that's not how Hank thinks. Of course, Luann is being asked to watch Lady Bird because you can't bring your dog to Japan with you. And Hank writes kind of a letter, but like in Lady Bird's voice, saying like, I like 2 scoops of kibble. I like long walks. I might try to get 3 scoops of kibble, but I know you're too smart to fall for that. And then Luann's like, I don't know. She was able to write this letter. And then Hank's just like, trips off. I like Hank's logic around a lot of things. Just, I mean, I don't know. The whole newspaper thing was kind of weird for me. Just like, I get having somebody take in your newspaper because if it piles up, then it's like a signal that nobody's there. But the whole, hey, that's a sign that, hey, this guy has enough money to afford a newspaper, so we should rob him. Where does that logic come from?
I mean, I don't know. It's like, that's Hank true. Is in a different world from the rest of us. But everyone else seems to like agree. No one was like, oh, that's not the reason why. They're like, yes. I love them trying to get into his truck, though. When they're like, should we add miles to the odometer? Is that a truck term? Or not a truck term, I guess.
Yeah, he's like, should we drive 10 miles a day to the car just so that in case the robbers check your odometer? And then Hank's like, no. They go to the airport. Cotton's feeling very uncomfortable. And then he's in like his military uniform, U.S. Army, all that good stuff, which I guess is an interesting choice, but whatever. And he's not really happy to go on the plane. He's not really happy about this trip. I don't know if it's just that he wasn't happy with it from the get-go, or if he's just uncomfortable with flights, or, I don't know, going back to Japan is triggering something for him, but he doesn't want to go. And then as they get to the counter, they see a Japanese woman, and they're like, he's like, there's a Japanese. And then Hank's like, hush, Dad, they're called Asians now. Which, really funny to hear, especially after the West East Side Story. They board the plane. Hank and Bobby are sitting in the exit row. And, you know, as it happens, the flight attendant shows up and is like, would you two be willing to assist in an emergency? And then Hank's like, yes. And then, you know, she looks to Bobby and she's like, is he over 13? And then Hank's like, yep. And then, of course, the flight attendant walks away. And then Hank grabs her and is like, excuse me, miss. Look, he's a good kid and everything, but he's not great in emergency. And then so Bobby gets a little upset. But Hank's like, sorry, Bobby. And then Bobby's like, you know me. And then he just walks away. Like, he kind of just accepts. Like, yeah, you're right. I probably wouldn't help out. And then, of course, we have Cotton now, who is getting super antsy. And now they're playing Pearl Harbor on the flight. And that's making Cotton uncomfortable. Now he's starting to have war flashbacks, and he's looking at the Japanese people on the plane, and he's seeing them as essentially zombies of soldiers he killed. And he's freaking out, and the flight attendant comes up, and it's like, oh, we, you know, if you don't behave, we're going to have to land this plane in Hawaii. Peggy goes up to Hank, and Hank is sitting next to an adult man who's drinking beer, and Hank's like, hey, I like beer as much as the next guy, but we're on duty here. And the guy just kind of looks at him and continues drinking. And then Peggy's like, Hank, there's something wrong with your dad. Okay, I'll go see him. You keep an eye on Hugh Hefner here. And they wind up drugging Cotton and storing him in the overhead compartment. They make it to Japan. That is so Hank Hill, the whole thing there. Like, Hank seriously taking it as, like, his, like, a serious duty for him to be on the exit door. Like, yes, of course you don't want to be, like, hammered or anything, but at the same time, if something happens, you could probably, if you were just unable to help, you could probably get the guy behind you or whatever to help out or something. It's like, come on now. Hank, just got to loosen up a little bit.
I mean, they did serve him the alcohol. Like, if they didn't think he could have a couple of drinks, then they wouldn't have served him, so.
I sat in the exit row many times and I've been served drinks. Like, yeah, if you're not supposed to drink when you're in the exit row, I'm pretty sure they would, at the very least, tell you that. Like, yeah, like on the ticket or something, like, oh, this is a non-alcoholic seat or something like that.
I don't know. I've sat in the exit row. It is, because I wanted the more leg room, but it's, like, not as glamorous as I thought it was. Because I was, like, your stuff is way in front of you because you got to put it, like, in the seat. Like in front of you, so it's like way there. I don't know. I feel like it's not worth the extra leg room, the exit seat.
I always find it funny that they always, I mean, I guess it's like legally required that they ask if you're willing to help, but I'm always like, has there ever been a situation where somebody was like, no? Or, you know, when they come up to you, they're like, oh, excuse me, you're in the exit row. Would you be willing to help in a case of an emergency? Like, has anybody ever said no to them?
I think if you do say no, they've, like, asked for volunteers to switch seats with you.
Probably, but I'm just like, who would actually say no, though?
I don't know. But don't you think it's, like, their, not, like, it's their job, but, like, isn't it their job? Like, if something happens, shouldn't they run over there and be like, I can open this door? Like, suddenly I have to open a door? It's like, Southwest isn't paying me.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. It's like, I'm supposed to be the hero now? Well, I definitely deserve some. Maybe that's the trade-off. Like, with great responsibility comes great leg room or something like that.
I don't know. I do want to write down one of those slides.
I want to write down one of the slides. I don't want to have to go through what you have to go through in order to experience that.
True. I mean, maybe just a door. I don't know. Maybe it's like some weird practice thing that I'm luckily on.
Oh, like if they had like a fake airplane or something where you could just like inflate the thing and then slide down.
Yeah, maybe. And, oh man, do they still say like you can use the seat cushions as a flotation device? They I always do. Think of Wanda Sykes' joke when I hear that. And she's like, I've never seen anyone in a plane crash floating on those seat cushions.
Yeah, that's a weird thought. I mean, I guess maybe if you crash at a lake or something, but it's like, oh, good. Just what I need to float across the North Atlantic. A seat cushion. They do make it to Japan. Let's go back to the Hills house, though, and see what's going on in Arlen. So Lady Bird is being fed by Luann. She brings a hard-boiled egg, but she brought it out like an hour later than she was supposed to. Lady Bird, being such an old dog, it's kind of slow and whatnot. Physically speaking. And so Luann's like, Lady Bird, I brought you the food, but Lady Bird wasn't responsive or anything. So Luann just assumed that Lady Bird died. And as soon as Luann runs away and puts the egg on the ground, you know, Lady Bird comes up, comes awake and eats the egg and then goes back to sleep. So, yeah, it's funny. I guess Luann didn't think to check to see if she was breathing or anything, but whatever. She does try to get a new bloodhound from the pound to try to, like, trick Hank, and then she takes the collar off of Lady Bird and gets ready to move her with the shovel, but then that motion, you know, sparks Lady Bird, and she runs around, and they get mixed up. Meanwhile, over at the Hill residence, the newspaper is, like, literally thrown, and it's probably on the ground for no more than 5 seconds. Dale comes by. And he just grabs the newspaper and he's like, burglary averted, but for how long? He goes, we should turn on a light in the house. So they try to open the doors and they're all locked. The windows are locked. And Dale's like, man, this is just begging to be broken into. And then they take Bill's shirt, break the window, open the window, go inside, turn on the light, repair the window. And they're like, well, now it looks so empty inside. What are we going to do? And so they go inside and they put on the Hills clothes. So Bill puts on Peggy's dress and Dale puts on like Hank's work shirt and glasses and drinks a beer. So I don't know. They're having fun, I guess. So anyway, we're back in Japan. They arrive and Cotton kind of comes to. It's actually kind of funny because they open the overhead and Peggy's like, wait, he might have shifted. And then, like, Cotton just falls out of the overhead bin onto the ground with, like, a liquor bottle. So they manage to drug him for a pretty long time. That would be pretty dangerous, I'm guessing, but okay. Yeah, so then Cotton's like, oh, where are we? Are we in Hawaii? He's like, no, Hank's like, no, we drugged you. We're in Japan. And then they get outside and all of a sudden they see the, I guess like a news camera, news crew from Japan. Apparently they got the word from the Arlen Bystander that they're doing this Widow in the Wallet story and they're wanting to record. He is not happy, so he runs back inside, run back into the plane, which I don't even think you can do. Like, I don't know that you could even run back into the plane after you've deplaned or unboarded or whatever. I don't know what that proper term is. But yeah, so he runs back in and Hank goes in after him. And then Hank is trying to figure out what's wrong with Cotton. And Hank's like, you know, our Cotton is like, you know, he doesn't want to be followed around by the cameraman. He doesn't want the woman to think that, you know, he came here just to be a Japanese celebrity or whatever. So Hank helps smuggle him out of the airplane by putting him in a duffel bag. They get to the hotel where Peggy says, oh, you can really see the Japanese inspiration, which, okay, cool, whatever. That makes perfect sense. I love when they go up to the room because I have had this experience in my own life going to Japan, going to Tokyo. They go up and they're having a hard time opening the door. Cotton's in his own room, but Bobby, Hank, and Peggy are in a separate room. And they struggle to open the door. When they open it, they just see this incredibly small, cramped room. And they're just like, what? How are we supposed to sleep here? They notice that one of the beds is a pullout. And then they realize that, oh, Bobby can just sleep at the desk or whatever that's in that little room. So, yeah, I've been to Japan. And while there are absolutely hotels with big rooms, don't get me wrong, I have absolutely spent sometimes in Tokyo in like essentially what amounted to a shoebox. Like, it was enough for me, a bed, a shelf, and like my suitcases. And then of course there was like a bathroom and like a little mini hallway in the room, and that was it.
I don't know. I've never been to Japan. I've been in some crappy hotels though, so I don't think it'd measure because they weren't shoebox size.
Yeah,
just dirty bed sheets.
Yeah, it really just depends on what you're willing to spend in Japan. Like, even the small hotels can be super expensive. And then there's the really, really cheap hotels, the capsule hotels, which are almost like sci-fi. Like, you know, when you watch on TV or in like space movies when they're flying through space and stuff and they have to go into like cryo sleep because it's this long flight. And so they put them in like these little tubes and they sleep in that. Like, that's literally essentially what a capsule hotel is. You sleep in what amounts to a horizontal tube, which is probably big enough for you and maybe a small bag. But it's like 20, 30 bucks a night. So I guess that's a trade-off. I also like, I like them breaking into the house because, I don't know, looking like at Arlen, especially looking at Rainy Street where they live and seeing previous episodes, it doesn't even look like the type of place that would be crime ridden in the first, like at all anyway. So like, I wouldn't even expect them to have a break in.
I'm surprised that Hank doesn't have a security system. I mean, they're more common now, but I feel like living next to Dale, you want a security system.
Yeah. Or not even that, just Hank being as paranoid, or not paranoid, but as like thorough as he is. He seems like the type of person who'd have a security system to make sure his house is safe. We go back to the Japan and we see Cotton and Hank. Hank goes into Cotton's room and Hank volunteers to help find this woman because he can see over fences that Cotton can't. And they're about to shake hands because, you know, Cotton is happy that Hank is helping out and helped him escape from the airplane. Right before they're about to shake hands, there's a knock at the door. Concierge is bringing in some flowers, some fresh pants, and a cologne. And which, you know, it's a little suspicious to Hank. It's like, what's all that for? And Cotton's like, oh, well, I soiled myself. That's why they gave me the cologne and the pants. And then all this, and then Hank's like, well, what about the roses? And, you know, Cotton's starting to get a little nervous. He's sweating. And then Hank notices like some brown liquid is coming off of his head. So he removes Cotton's hat and his hair is brown. And Hank's like, did you dye your hair? And he's like, it's shoe polish. So Hank's like looking around and he's thinking to himself. Oh, he puts together. Oh, this woman isn't a widow. You slept with her, didn't you? And then Cotton's like, a lot. And so now Hank's like upset because he thought, you know, Cotton was here to make peace over a murder, over killing this person in a war and widowing a woman and stuff. But no, it was just him wanting to reconnect with an old flame. Hank's upset at this. And of course, Peggy is too, because she's already wrote the story on the plane, which I guess creative, I guess, to do. Like, there's the things haven't happened yet, but she's already written the story. But then, you know, Bobby's all optimistic as always, and he's like, oh, well, you know, maybe this is a better story. And then Peggy's like, you're right. You know, he killed 50 men, but he came back to Japan not for the 50 he killed, but for the one he left behind. Peggy's like, I wouldn't be surprised if they made a movie about this. And then Hank's like, they wouldn't want to make a movie about a philanderer. And then, you know, Cotton shows up, knocks on the door, and asks for pictures of Hank. Peggy's like, well, I've got plenty of pictures of me. Oh, here's a picture of me, Bobby, and Hank. And Cotton's like, that'll do. And then so Peggy's like, Cotton wouldn't take a picture of his son to, like, some random hookup or whatever. Like, there's more to it than that here. So Hank kind of comes around and decides that, okay, maybe Cotton's not as bad as a guy and this isn't as bad of a situation. They get into a cab, they come up, and they're like, oh, this must be where we are because these squiggly lines on the door look like the squiggly lines on this paper. They get up to the door of the apartment and Cotton is a little nervous because he doesn't know what to think. Will she recognize me? Yada, yada, yada. And they knock on the door and somebody opens it. It's a middle-aged man who looks exactly like a Japanese version of Hank Hill. And the episode ends on that cliffhanger. So, yeah, I think one of the nice things to me was the fact that it did show that there was something deeper here. Because, yeah, why would Cotton, one, keep a picture of a woman from, like, 50 years ago in his wallet, 50-plus years ago in his wallet? And then even if he did, like, clearly she means something more to him than just, like, oh, yeah, she was just the hot little thing that I had in Japan, and now I kind of want to get some again, which is also something Peggy picks up, which is also the Peggy points out, like, nobody cheats on their 40-year-old wife with an 80-year-old flame. So, yeah, it's nice to see, it's nice to see kind of this more humanistic side of Cotton.
Yeah, I think it's just, like, the one you always remember. Or maybe Cotton isn't this kind of playboy that we think he is. You know, like, maybe he's a lot of show and this was, like, the one time he, like... Because this would be way before he met Hank's mom, right?
Yeah. This would have been well before then.
So, maybe, like, you know, this is his first true love.
Yeah, that's probably it. Or it definitely means something to him if he kept that picture all these years and wanted to go see her and stuff, so... Yeah, it definitely meant something to him. Probably his first love or first real love or something. But yeah, and then apparently he left something behind in Japan more than just her, because we get to see that apparently he has a half-Japanese son. And like, well, those of you who've seen the episode know exactly what I'm talking about. Those who haven't, he literally looks like a Japanese version of Hank Hill. Like, that is the best way to describe it. Like, that is the only way to describe it. It looks like a mirror image of just the, you know, they gave him black Japanese style straight hair and kind of, you know, Japanese facial features and stuff, but he still looks just like Hank.
Which is interesting because Hank doesn't look like Cotton or his mom, really. But then his like half brother looks exactly like these are some strong genes coming down the line.
Yeah,
where they come from.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because he doesn't look like Cotton at all. He actually does look a lot like Tilly, his mom. But then it raises the question because Tilly has nothing to do with this other guy, and yet he looks exactly like Hank. So it's like, okay, maybe he got his looks from the Cotton side of the family then, I guess. Maybe grandfather, I don't know, great-grandpa, something like that.
I don't know. I think it's just the glasses.
Maybe.
With Hank and his mom. I don't know. I don't really see it in those two. I don't know. Now I feel like Cotton and Dee Dee's child is going to look like Hank as well. Yeah. Even though he's more rounder now. But he'll just like rectangle up, I guess.
Yeah. Like if they do the reboot or whatever, like in 20 years have passed and we have good Hank being like 22 years old or whatever. Yeah, that'd be pretty funny to see. But yeah, this was a pretty good episode. I mean, I can relate to some of it. Now I can. I actually didn't go to Japan for the first time until like, I don't know, I want to say like 5 years ago, 6 years ago, something like that. So, you know, I couldn't relate to it when I first saw the show. But after seeing the show, I can definitely relate to some of the experiences that they had. I don't know. It's just funny. I think the one thing I really like about this particular episode is that it does show that Cotton's not like he usually is just this terrible person that you don't want to have around. But like deep, deep, deep down inside of it, he's a nicer person than we think.
Yeah, Cotton. Yeah. No. I mean, I enjoy that. Also, like when Hank and he meets his half brother, they let out the same like Hank cry. And I'm like, is that genetic as well?
I guess so. Even though we don't really see Cotton. I don't think we ever have Cotton make those kind of noises.
But yeah, they do that, what is it, like, blah, or like, whoa, kind of sound that Hank makes when he's frightened.
Yeah, they just do that, oh, sound, and then it goes to black.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was a really fun episode. Can't wait to see what happens next, but you all will have to tune in next week to find that. Or I guess you can just watch the show and then listen to us again. But anyway, this has been fun. But yeah, thank you all for listening. And I am Jason.
I'm Jimmy.
Bye.
Bye.